Maturity. We often think it comes with age, as if the young can't possibly have it, and the old get it automatically. But age, it's got little to do with it. In relationships, maturity isn't measured by your birthday. It's measured by your behavior. So let's get personal for a second. If you had to guess your maturity age, not your chronological age, where do you think you would land? Today, we're going to ask you if you're willing to take a hard look in the mirror and ask yourself the following question. Do I have room for improvement in this area?
So today we are digging into what emotional maturity, what maturity looks like, and we're going to explore one of its greatest litmus tests, which is your ability to disagree in a respectful, loving way. So stick with us as we explore how this skill can make or break your relationship. Up next on Master Your Marriage. Welcome back to a new episode. I'm Charla Snow, and I'm here with my husband, Robert, my amazing tan Robert.
I've got the tan going today, which is kind of nice.
We did a little river float this weekend, and of course, one little trek down the river, and Robert's tan as can be.
30 minutes. It's all I need.
But we also have some amazing news from this last weekend. You want to share what that is? What is it?
Oh, yeah. We're grandparents. Yeah, that happened this weekend too.
We're out camping. It did on Saturday.
Didn't happen while we're camping. It happened to them in a different city.
But our firstborn had his firstborn, and she weighed almost 9 pounds.
That's a baby.
21 and a half inches long. She's a big girl, and we are so excited to go and meet her.
Yeah.
So that's our news. But today here on the podcast, we're going to be talking about disagreeing and disagreeing respectfully and why this is a true test of emotional maturity.
Does this mean we're going to fight during this podcast?
Hopefully not.
Okay.
We wouldn't be very mature.
No, that's right. Yeah. Okay.
So why does this matter? Because in all honesty, it will make or break your relationship.
There's good research on that.
And we do. We're going to bring the research to back this up.
Yeah. So you've heard us talk about the Gottmans, Dr. John Gottman. In lots of different episodes, but he spent his entire life studying the predictability of relationships. The question that he asked was, could he predict with any level of accuracy whether a relationship would make it? By make it, we mean stay together, get divorced, or stay together unhappily, right? Mm-hmm. And we all know the well-published statistics, roughly half of all relationships make it, half don't. So the question is there any rhyme or reason to why half make it and why half don't? And which half will you be in?
Right.
And moreover, how do we not just make it, but actually be one of those couples that thrive? They love being together. They love dreaming together. They have this amazing connection. They have these rituals. They have friendship. And the question we ask is, what does it take to have this type of relationship? Mm-hmm. And is this even reasonable in today's world to have this outcome?
To be one of the
50%, if we're talking about that,
right,
that have this great enduring relationship.
And truthfully, it's actually less than 50%.
Yes.
Because the 50% that technically stay together, a lot of those aren't actually happy.
Yeah.
So John Gottman followed hundreds of couples for decades through all of life's ups and downs. And after all of that, he found that it's not about luck. It's not just a coin toss. It's about how you fight. And his research points to 8 specific behaviors that will predict divorce with over 90% accuracy.
That's so scary.
Like 94% accuracy.
Yes.
But if you look even more closely at those 8 predictors, what you'll see is that they all have one thing in common. They are all behaviors that happen to couples when they disagree. So nothing is more important for the health of your relationship than learning how to work through your differences maturely. And at the end of the day, all the good that you put into your relationship, all the good things that you put into it are eventually going to be undone if you can't sit down at the table and talk to each other like grownups and work through your differences.
I like the grown-up part, right?
Yeah. So what does it take?
Emotional maturity.
It takes emotional maturity.
A lot of it at times, right?
A lot of it at times.
Yeah. So now would probably be a good time to define this term that we just talked about, emotional maturity, because we hear that term, we hear it thrown about all over the place, but do we really know what it means? Okay. Emotional maturity is when you can recognize your emotions, understand why you feel them, and handle them in a productive, effective way. Being emotionally mature assists us in staying calm during stressful situations. It's what allows us to pause, before we react, and then choose an action that comes from the best part of us.
The best version of ourselves.
Yeah.
Right. Emotional maturity also helps you to be able to look at how your actions affect other people. It's not just about you. Instead of, you know, simply flying off the handle, reacting automatically, just being on autopilot all the time, you're able to make decisions that are not only good for you, but also good for your partner, good for the relationship, and good for everyone that is connected to it, your kids, your family. Being emotionally mature doesn't mean that you never get upset, though. It's not that you don't ever make mistakes. Certainly, we're all human. We are going to have emotions. We're not robots. But with emotional maturity, you'll be able to generally manage those ups and downs and all of those feelings in a productive way while learning from your experiences.
Yeah. So in a nutshell, emotional maturity is emotional intelligence, self-control, and personal responsibility all rolled up into one. Mm-hmm. It's your ability to choose your relationship's well-being over your personal ego, which means putting off the need to be right and bringing to this disagreement more understanding, more compassion, more empathy.
Perfect. And as we talk about all of these things, Robert, they sound like really important stuff. You know, especially when it comes to being able to maintaining an open dialogue where two very different people have two differing viewpoints and need to figure out a way through it.
It's always going to happen.
Right. So undoubtedly, after we've described what emotional maturity is, I'm sure you can see that it is a vital skill. But here's the challenge. It seems like it is something that is becoming more and more elusive in our world.
Yeah, it reminds me of, because you said it's a vital skill. And it reminds me of a good friend of ours, Jackie. I don't know that she listens to the podcast, but Jackie said, sometimes you have to skill up.
Yeah. And this is one of those times.
And when it comes to being in a relationship, I think you need to skill up.
Yeah. So why is it that it seems like this is becoming so much more difficult? Maturity, why does it seem to be so elusive today?
Well, it's about our day and age, and it's where we're at as a society, right? And us people, humans, are becoming less capable of tolerating any opposing perspectives. Exactly. And oftentimes we almost go to any length to just maintain our viewpoint. I need to be right. I think the problem that we have is in our society, we're not being exposed to opposing views very often.
Mm.
We sort of live in this echo chamber that I'm going to talk about. When we're not used to opposing viewpoints, we sort of become entrenched in our own viewpoints, and we don't have any patience to think or see outside of the voices that we tend to listen to. And you'll see this a lot in politics, but a lot more on social media. But then we start to see this sort of flow over into your relationship.
Yeah. And in relationships, kind of as you're saying, instead of seeing differing viewpoints as normal, natural, healthy, even positive, couples often see these differences that they have as a reason to shut down, a reason to go to war with each other, or maybe even a sign that their relationship is over, that their relationship is broken. I mean, if you think about it, how often do you hear people say things like, well, I guess we just weren't meant to be.
Yeah.
Or yeah. I guess you're just not my soulmate. Or maybe I guess we've just grown apart. We hear that all the time because we're so different. So too many times, I think these statements that we hear people make, they're really more like rationalizations, justifications that our brain is making as a way to kind of manage this cognitive dissonance that we have so that we can avoid growing up and accepting the fact that conflicting opinions are normal and healthy, and we need to figure out a way to work through our differences in a grown-up and respectful way.
I love that. Say that again. Conflicting opinions.
That we have, it's just, I think it's our way sometimes of managing the discomfort that comes from having these conflicting viewpoints. But the reality is that conflicting opinions are normal, they're natural, they're healthy, and they're actually good.
I love that, because we've always heard that conflicting opinions in today's world are bad.
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
Or you're evil, you don't think like me.
Yeah. So what do you think about this idea that, you know, I just need to trade in this relationship's not working for me because we're too different. I just need to maybe try to find another one. What do you think about that?
Well, if you decide that you need to pick someone else, that's fine. I mean, we don't recommend that. But if you decide you're going to pick someone else, you're only going to pick someone else's problems.
Totally.
So you'll just find another set of things to disagree about. And in all committed relationships, even highly successful relationships, disagreements are inevitable and they're healthy. Yeah. And this is because we have different temperaments, different backgrounds, different perspectives, yep, and different life experiences. Dr. John Gottman's research found that nearly 70% of all marital conflicts are perpetual and unsolvable.
Wow. 70%.
Right? So think about that. 70% of all disagreements, we say this a lot on the podcast,
yeah,
are unsolvable.
What's
so
that mean?
What that means is when you pick your person, you're picking 70% of your fights,
yep,
or disagreements. You're not going to solve them. You're going to have to repeat that same disagreement. You're going to have that come up again for the next 10, 20, 30, 40 years. And perpetual means that couples continue to disagree on the same topic year over year after year. It's never fully solved. It just keeps getting revisited over and over and over. And sometimes it's finances. Sometimes it's parenting with us. We have a perpetual conversation about parenting.
Yep.
Sometimes it's something else. But whatever it is, this is going to resurface over and over again. But just because the problem isn't solvable, because mm-hmm, it's a perpetual problem, mm-hmm, doesn't mean it can't be managed.
Right, exactly.
Nor does it mean that it needs to damage the relationship. And it won't damage the relationship if you'll manage this problem with emotional maturity.
Mm.
Gaining emotional maturity will allow you to navigate your differences with love, with respect, and with some decency.
And wisdom.
And I wisdom. Love that. Yeah.
So I want to spend a little bit of time talking about something we talked about earlier, which is why or what we see as the greater problem behind this. And as I see it, emotional maturity is a muscle, and it's a muscle that has to be developed. It's not an easy muscle to develop. And like, yeah, any muscle, that means you have to put it through stress in order for it to get stronger. When we don't exercise a muscle, what happens? It is going to become weaker. It's going to atrophy. And I think there's a good amount of evidence out there that our maturity muscle is something that is atrophying as a people, as a society, as a culture. So let's kind of talk about why.
Yeah. I mean, I think I alluded to this earlier, but one of the big reasons is the way that we communicate today.
Mm-hmm.
Think about what used to happen. It used to be a lot of face-to-face, right? But now we don't communicate that way. Our world is more and more digital. Mm-hmm. And some of this was brought, this was way before COVID started, but now it's even more with Zoom, mm-hmm, meetings and things, mm-hmm, like that. But while technology has made our life much easier in a lot of ways, it's also created barriers to building emotional maturity. So think about our keyboard warriors out there,
mm-hmm,
ones who are just happy to just fight and disagree. Mm-hmm. Think about how much time we spend on our screens, just even now, even if you don't want to, right? How much time we spend scrolling, consuming social media, texting, skipping from one app to the other. Like, these tools are convenient, but they're shaping how we think. They're shaping how we argue, mm-hmm, and how we connect with each other, and even how we connect and relate to our spouses and our significant, yes, others.
I think that's so important to think about, how it is training us to think differently and how to fight differently and how to disagree differently.
Oh, and there's some more stuff coming up about that.
So let's talk a little bit about echo chambers.
Yeah.
So you've probably heard the term echo chamber, but what does it actually mean? So an echo chamber is when you're surrounded by people, ideas, and content that reinforces what you already believe. And social media platforms are designed to be an echo chamber. They're designed to keep you hooked for a reason. And think about it. If your social media feed was full of things that you couldn't stand, how much time would you be spending on, say, Instagram or Facebook? You'd,
right,
be off in seconds. So instead, the AI, the technology, the algorithms, they learn what it is that you like, your likes, your dislikes, your clicks, your shares. It learns from you, and then it starts to feed you more of what it is that you like. So if you lean one way politically, or if you enjoy certain hobbies, or if you, let's say, even have a strong opinion about something, for example, you brought up parenting earlier, then the algorithm is going to learn that, and it's going to show you things that match whatever viewpoints that you have.
Yeah, absolutely. And over time, you become then less exposed to different perspectives, and your world just gets smaller and smaller. I guess we could say it keeps you in your comfort zone, right? And it doesn't let you exercise your emotional maturity muscles. And since you're not engaging as much with maybe these diverse ideas, it makes you less likely to practice empathy and even open-mindedness.
Exactly.
You're seeing and hearing the same thing all the time. And then, totally, as a result, you become, as we all have to some extent, less tolerant of differing viewpoints.
Mm. Yeah. And another thing that I think is interesting about social media is that algorithms tend to prioritize very emotionally charged and polarizing content. Because why? Those are the things that go viral. And all creators of content on social media, they know that to get a post to go viral, it can't just be like good information. It has to be sort of polarizing.
Picture of you with your cat, right?
No, it needs to be, it really needs to get people angsty and worked up a little bit. But what's that also going to do? It's going to fuel outrage. And as a result, this outrage has been shown to further confirm our biases. So it makes us even more entrenched. We know that from research that the more someone disagrees with you, the more entrenched you tend to get in your position and the less capable you are of being able to see the gray, to see the nuance. And so the internet has just become so full of these groups, these fragmented pieces of like-minded people who will hold similar viewpoints and hold extreme viewpoints because they rarely get challenged by alternative ideas and perspectives.
Yeah. So true. The new danger we're seeing is how large language models, LLMs like ChatGPT and AI, are being programmed to become yet another echo chamber in your life.
This is super interesting to think about.
Yeah. A lot of people are using these tools as a therapist. That's a little frightening. A friend and even an intimate partner. They're asking ChatGPT for advice, like, what should I do when I have an estranged relationship? Or what should I do about my family dynamic? The risk here is that as we interact with these models, we need to understand that they're also programmed to keep us engaged, just like social media. Yep. They're programmed to pattern match your language, in essence, to please you. So this can be really problematic when we bring our own biases to the conversation.
Super interesting to think about. Let's talk about a few examples that might be helpful here to illustrate what Robert's talking about. So in one example, in 2021, there was a Belgian man who was really having a lot of anxiety. He was really struggling with anxiety over climate change. And so he got on to an AI chatbot that was called Chai, and he was looking for support. I'm hearing more and more of these stories over the last couple of years of people turning to ChatGPT or these types of things as a friend, as a confidant, as someone who has emotions when they don't, someone who can guide them when they really can't.
Their job is to feed back to you
what you want.
What you want,
right? And so anyway, in this case, taking place over several weeks, and the chatbot was responding and kind of feeding back what he was looking for. And as this happened, it actually deepened his depression, his despair, his anxiety just got worse and worse, even suggesting at some point the chatbot even suggested self-harm as an option. And tragically, he ended up taking his own life.
Yeah, it likely echoed his.
It did.
Yeah.
It was an echo chamber.
Yeah.
And this was a case that was, you could read about it. It was in the New York Times at the time. And it just showed how you got to be careful with validation, because AI can validate in a way that can be harmful, validate these harmful emotions or validate this harmful thinking.
Yeah.
So in another example, and this was a personal one recently, I had a client tell me that ChatGPT was such a great therapist. And so I wanted
Might have been a clue there.
Super curious about this. Yeah. Tell me about it. I want to understand. But in this case, the problem, of course, was that the prompts that he was feeding into ChatGPT were really biased. It had biased thinking. And so it led to responses that ended up reinforcing his thinking. And it ended up escalating a conflict that he was having with someone in his life. And as a result of this conversation with AI, his views and his blaming of other people, it actually just got worse. And he ended up blowing a whole relationship over.
Yeah, blew it right up.
Blew it up.
Yeah. On top of these type of echo chambers, there's also been this decline, as we talked about earlier, in face-to-face interaction in society.
Yes.
So before we had smartphones and social apps, disagreements happened person to person, walking home from school, in the hallways, in person, coffee, you know, having coffee, family dinners.
How about Thanksgiving dinner?
Think about
how many people don't even go to Thanksgiving dinner anymore because they can't handle what conversations are going to happen around the table.
There's always going to be disagreement.
And that's where we used to have those conversations. Yeah.
And those moments forced you to see the other person, to see their humanity, to see their facial expressions, their tone of voice, their emotions, right? research shows us that face-to-face communication actually helps reduce this polarization and helps us to have more empathy. And wouldn't we have more empathy if we could just see that as we said something, how the other person got
was
hurt.
Affected by that.
Right. Versus the tick, tick, tick.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And there's actually a study that backs this up as well. There was a study by Louisa Santos, and she found that, as Robert just described, these in-person discussions, even if they were about contentious topics like politics, they still, if they were done in person, face-to-face, where we could exercise empathy and see each other's expressions, it decreased dislike by 20%.
That's huge.
So think about it. When we fight with people, you know, in a digital way, we just have so much hatred towards them.
It's easy.
But if you do it face to face, it decreases the dislike by 20%. It helps to increase respect. It helps to increase empathy because you're confronted now with a human, with the full context of someone else's perspective. But today, instead of doing that, we're texting. I have couples who don't even talk to each other. They email and they text each other when they're going through problems, right? We're texting instead of talking, or worse, we're avoiding tough conversations altogether. And I think because we're spending more time on social apps than face-to-face interaction, it's creating this feedback loop where you're less exposed to real world differences. And so you become less practiced at being able to handle them. And so it just becomes this perpetuating loop of declining emotional maturity.
Yeah, we're going to avoid what we're uncomfortable with.
Yeah.
And if we don't know how to have a face-to-face conversation, mm-hmm. we don't know how to just have a disagreement, then we're going to avoid it.
Yeah.
Just even the world, and just seeing the world as I have different employees, some of my younger employees, oftentimes, you know, we'll have somebody who just won't show up because they had a disagreement and they just don't know how to deal with it.
Yeah. Think of that.
So in the context of relationships, what does this mean? I think these cultural shifts are making us all a lot more rigid and more likely to see your spouse's differing opinion as a threat.
Yes.
Rather than an opportunity to grow, to learn about one another. The less we practice engaging in differences in the real world, the harder it is to bring this emotional maturity to those inevitable conflicts that we're going to have. We have to have at home. And as we've said, those conflicts aren't going away. 70% of them are perpetual, based on Dr. Gottman's research. The question for you is, are you working on building the strength to manage your differences respectfully, or are you letting the world or modern social media habits weaken your emotional maturity?
What a good question. I think that's a good question for all of us to sort of sit with and reflect on. Like, am I letting all these conveniences of modern life to actually weaken my emotional maturity and my muscle to atrophy?
Well, I think a great clue would be if you are if you're having a disagreement moment with your partner and your first instinct is to text them to tell you, to tell them how difficult it is, mm-hmm. or how you're unhappy with them, that might be a sign. That might be a sign.
All right. Well, let's wrap up this episode with a few things that you can start doing today to build your emotional maturity and manage differences with your spouse in a way that is actually strengthening that muscle and strengthening your marriage or your relationship. We're going to share some practical down-to-earth strategies that I think you'll find really helpful. They're things we've talked about on the show before, but I think they're worth revisiting. They are simple things, but they aren't easy things.
No.
They do take a lot of practice, especially when you are in the heat of a disagreement. These are things that will go out the window the moment that you start to get heated. So
absolutely.
But it's good to revisit them.
Welcome to the podcast, because we're definitely going to give you homework.
Okay.
It wouldn't be Master Your Marriage unless you had some things to do.
All right. So what's the first practical?
Practice the pause. When you feel that flush, that rush, or you're getting fired up, like when your spouse says something that sets you off, don't react immediately. That instant urge to snap back, that's your first wave of consciousness. And it comes from your limbic system or your adaptive child, as we've talked about in the past. And trust me, anything you say from that place is going to be hurtful. It's going to be sharp and damaging. Instead, we want you to take a deep breath, count to 2, 3, or 5, right? Step away for a moment. This gives your prefrontal cortex, that part of your brain that thinks clearly, a chance to come back online. While you're pausing, challenge your own story. And here's a couple questions that we want you to ask yourself. Ask yourself this: what am I pretending to not know about my role in this problem? Or why would somebody reasonable and rational
i.e. your partner.
Yeah, i.e. your person, your partner. So why would a reasonable and rational person think this way or do this thing?
Mm, I love those questions. Those are two of my favorites. You know, why would, when Robert says something to me, I get flushed or I get that rush. I feel charged up. I have to remind myself, okay, why would he think that? Why would he do that? Why would he say that? Because he is a reasonable, rational person. This is the person I love most in the whole world. So before I just react, like, why might he?
Before I carve him up.
Why might? Yeah. Just get curious about why he might think that way.
Yeah.
And then take a moment to kind of put this back on myself too. Like, what role am I playing here?
I think those are the two best questions. Like, what's my part?
Yes.
And why might they feel this way?
Exactly.
Those two. Yeah.
And research shows that when you pause before reacting, it helps you to respond again from your prefrontal cortex, which is your best self, not from your ego or your adaptive child. So for example, if your spouse says, you never help with the kids. Well, first of all, that's not a great phrase to come at with somebody never. With a never statement. Yeah. But you just heard it. Are you going to get fired up about that? Or are you going to pause and self-confront, ask these questions, and then maybe see some truth in it and say, you know what? Okay. I mean, you're probably right a little bit there. I probably have been stretched a little thin lately. So maybe we should talk about this.
Yeah. And it reminds me of one of our favorite quotes on the show that's most often attributed to Viktor Frankl, which is,
mm-hmm.
Sharla.
Yeah. It's between stimulus and response, there is a space. And in that space is our power to choose our response. In that response lies our growth and our freedom. So think about that whole quote for just a second. I mean, between that stimulus, if Robert between says something up, to me, right?
And what you say.
Before I say something or do something, there is a space. I can lengthen that space.
Yeah.
I can lengthen that space as much as I need to be able to be wise. And in that space is where I'm going to find my power. And in my response is going to lie my freedom.
Yeah. I think the bigger that space, if you look at it as the window in the space between stimulus and response, mm-hmm. if you, the more you open up that space, the more you'll find a grown up.
Mm-hmm. There she is.
There's a grown up. Oh, okay. What would a grown up do?
Yeah.
And the smaller spaces, we're going to find that adaptive child.
I think so.
So just like pause, let that space open so the grown up can come into the room.
I think so. Sometimes we need to really wait for it to become a really big window.
Yeah. Sometimes.
Yeah.
It's a big grown up we want to come in.
Okay. So first is find the pause. What's
find
the second
the pause.
One?
Second, listen for what's true. And that's what we talked about. What is your part? Right? When your partner shares something that's difficult, like feedback about how you've been distant or, you know, you're on the phone too much or something, don't immediately scan for the inaccuracies in their position. That's a trap. Instead, listen to the part of what they're saying that might be true that might apply to you. Even if you disagree with all the rest of it, start by finding out what part is true, what part is yours, what you can own with. Right? And start your response with, you know what? I agree with part of what you're saying. And then own it. You say, yeah, you know what? You're right. I can see how you feel that way. And when you do this, it demonstrates that you're prioritizing the relationship over the need to be right. Mm-hmm. So if your spouse says, you know, you're always on the phone, own that crap, right? I agree. I've been checking my phone too much during dinner. That's on me. Yeah. And it may sound like you're on your phone. You don't care about me or the kids. Okay.
Yeah.
What part of that's true? The part is I'm definitely on my phone too much. I can manage that. Uh-huh. So let me do this part as far as don't care about the kids. That's, again, their limbic system just shooting out fast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So first one was space, find space. Second one was listen for what is true, even if it's only 10% of what the other person is saying. Third is focus on when you are speaking, focus on describing yourself, not your partner. So to do that, you want to use I statements so that you can share what's you are experiencing, what is going on inside of you. And you want to do that without pointing fingers. So you can say something like, I felt overwhelmed when I came home to a messy kitchen, instead of, oh my gosh, you're so lazy. Why do you never clean up anything? Yeah. So I can describe myself or I can describe you. Yeah, so you want to describe yourself. And in doing that, you're avoiding blame, you're avoiding criticism, you're avoiding retaliation, which are all, of course, as you know, relationship killers. I statements are obviously going to be less charged. Again, focus on your experience, not your partner's flaws. Instead of you never listen, try I feel unheard when we talk about money.
Yeah. I statements.
I statements.
I statements equal emotional maturity.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So fourth, ask good questions to understand your partner's perspective. Before you push your own point of view, become curious. one of our favorite questions is, tell me why this is important to you, or tell me more about this. These questions show that you're not just waiting for your turn to talk, but you're genuinely trying to get the lay of the land. You're trying to understand where they're coming from, what part in their statement might be true. As mentioned earlier, this increases empathy. It reduces this polarization and disagreement. So if you're arguing about finances, ask, what's important to you about this part of the budget or the budget overall? You might learn something that shifts the whole conversation and mellows the entire conversation.
All right. Last tip for developing emotional maturity is going to be become open to changing your position.
Oh, yeah.
Emotional maturity means letting go of your ego, your need to be right, and allowing yourself to be influenced by your partner's perspectives, your partner's ideas, their experiences. Are you really willing to hear your spouse out and let their perspective influence your perspective? And this isn't just about like, oh, just caving in or resentfully accommodating the other person and giving them what they want, even though you're mad about it on the inside. It's not about that. It's about being flexible enough to see their side, find out what's true in it, see things that you might want to adopt, and maybe shift your stance based on what you learn from them. And if you're someone who becomes dead set on being right, what's interesting about that, and this is shown in the research, is that you actually are someone who has less influence in your relationship.
Yeah.
If you're someone who is dead set, I'm right, you're wrong, you think that you're pushing through your and that you're so influential, but the truth is you have far less influence. You have far less ability to be persuasive, to have influence, unless you are willing to yourself allow yourself to be influenced. So for example, if you're disagreeing on parenting, like Robert said, we have many times, listen to your spouse's reasoning. Listen to what's important to them in their position. Listen to what values and morals are behind that. And then consider, wow, maybe their approach actually has some merit. Maybe there's a way forward here where we can kind of try a mix of what's important to me and what's more important to you, and even come up with something more amazing than what I would have come up with on my own.
Absolutely. So there you have it. Those are five ways to build your emotional maturity and handle disagreements with love, compassion, and respect. These aren't just tricks, they're skills that take time to develop, but they will transform how you and your spouse navigate those inevitable conflicts, especially those 70% that Dr. Gottman says are perpetual. Your marriage isn't about avoiding fights, it's about fighting well. So take a moment today, think about the last disagreement that you had with your spouse. I always say that, like, what was the last thing we argued about?
Something
I don't know,
stupid.
Because it was dumb, something stupid, right? Your last disagreement was always dumb. Mm-hmm. And when your clearer heads come
prevail
to the table, all mm-hmm. of a sudden you can't believe you're arguing about that, right? So think about the last thing, the last disagreement you had with your spouse. How did you show up? Were you flexing your maturity muscle, or did it feel a little weak? Start small. Try one of these strategies and watch how it strengthens your connection.
Well, that's a wrap for today. Thank you so much for being here. If this episode resonated with you, please subscribe to the show. We drop a new episode every week. And please leave us a review and a 5-star rating and share this episode with others, because it helps us to get the word out. It helps us to be able to help more couples to have secure relationships.
Absolutely. As always, be kind to each other. Put each other first. Remember, it's the small things done often that make the greatest impact.
Until next time.